Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Paul Orlando, renowned global startup wizard and serial entrepreneur. Paul, thank you for sharing your experiences with our audience.
It's my pleasure to be here, Stephen. Thank you.
Paul, you have this just really simply remarkable background. So can you share your top five lessons from running a lean startup bootcamp called Startups Unplugged?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk a bit about that. Some of the things that I've found in setting up this new program, which is a three-month lean startup bootcamp in Hong Kong, has been that it's really important to get the local community behind you and to get support from local mentors, other partners. I've been very happy to be able to do that. Another lesson that I found has been that lean startup and customer development methodology, they seem on paper to be quite easy and straightforward, but they're actually really hard to do in practice. And I always find that the startups that I work with, they have to learn a bit of this the hard way, but I try to help them along and speed up their learning as best as I can. Another really interesting piece of that is, since in lean startup, in customer development, you really want to go out and interact with your potential customers very early on. What I find is no one really likes to do that. So no one really likes to go out and interview a set of potential customers. It's just not comfortable. It's not natural for most people. And so getting people to be comfortable with that process is really important. And I also think it's very important to make any program that, any program that I do or any program that I think that's out there, it should really be very relevant to the individuals in the program itself. So you can have your overall general format that you might follow, again and again, but it's very important to make that specific to who is participating at any given time. And I always try to, add relevance based on what people are maybe having trouble with, where they need a little extra attention, or even bring in, specific, additional mentors, from the outside where they really have a great, background to help out. When I first started to do this program last summer, I also had a number of people tell me that, Hong Kong was not really the right place to run this in the beginning. The market wasn't big enough. But what I had found through talking to a lot of early stage companies was that there really was an interest and a need out there. And I've been very happy to help start to fill this need. And, it's helped me able to work with entrepreneurs who have flown in from other countries. I've had about a third of them have traveled in from other places to participate. And I've also worked with people remotely. So in one case, I had someone who last minute couldn't travel in. I ended up working with them completely remotely. And even in the demo day, they did it combination of via Skype and other recorded content that they had. So I've really had a great time running this program, and I'm looking forward to growing it.
It's interesting. You shared some of these lessons about lean startup customer development, and the audience may not know what you really mean by that. What is the essence of that? What are the sort of the best practices about lean startup customer development?
Sure. And these are two terms that I usually use together, if only to remind people that they are related and that they, it's almost that, lean startup came from, customer development. So just very briefly, the history of that is, a guy called Steve Blank, serial entrepreneur, developed a methodology which he called customer development, which he usually describes as having four stages, everything from customer discovery, customer validation, and these are the stages where you're searching for what your business is about, who your customer is, what market you're in, and then later on when you've actually gone and validated that you're on the right track, you then get into what he calls customer creation and company building, which are really about execution. And lean startup, by contrast, comes from a guy called Eric Ries, who was actually at one time a student of Steve Blank. And he talks about many of the many similar things. He often speaks a bit more about techniques that you can use to experiment and learn quickly and ways that you can test your ideas. So I usually talk about both of them together, and I use different practices from both. But what I found very interesting is that when I work with early stage startups, they often really act as though, at least in the beginning, you know, they tend to act as though they're already in the execution phases of that customer development model that I just briefly described. You know, they act as though they've already validated that their idea is great, that they have a business model, and it's just about execution. And that's where I really try to get people to pause a bit and say, well, let's go and actually test this. Let's go, you know, before you run off ahead, before you build too much, before you spend too much of your own time and resources simply executing on what is it right now, just an idea. Let's go and test some things. And this is where I find a lot of really early stage startups, it's very easy for them to just run off and, you know, write code for 6 months, not encounter a single customer, you know, until they feel that they're done, or continue to work on their design, waiting for it to be, just perfect, waiting to, trying to get every single bug out and not really understanding that they might be building something that no one wants, and they might not be thinking about, well, what their business model is. So, and, you know, they might not be thinking about how they could even spend their time more efficiently by working on what is actually providing more value. So I try to get people to think a bit more about that and actually go step by step with them in that process.
So it sounds like this is also tied in with this concept called MVP, minimal viable product.
That's correct. That's one way, and that's a process that Eric Ries talks about in the Lean Startup. That's one technique that can be used to test out ideas, and too often to test ideas quite quickly. So there's a number of ways that you can use an MVP to learn, and there's a number of MVP techniques. But some of the more common ones, and some of the ones that I often encourage people to experiment with early on, are range from the very simple, which are simply going out and interviewing potential customers. So, identifying, say, an initial customer segment that you think you are providing value to, and talking to them, and understanding, what questions you need to ask, what you need to learn, and then taking that information back as a way of determining, are you on the right track or not? And the interesting thing, is that really very few people are comfortable doing this, and actually very few people are able to do it well in the beginning. Certainly when I was starting out and, a few years ago when I was doing something like this customer interview process, without any guidance, without having, read these books, because, at least in the case of the Lean Startup, the book had not been written yet. I thought that I was going out and learning from customers and interviewing them. And it took me a while to realize that I was asking the wrong questions. So I used to ask, for example, hypothetical questions that don't really teach you that much. Because people are polite when they answer. If you ask them, would you like to use this new service? It's very easy for people to say, yes, of course I would. And if you just take that, that politeness or that, that inability that people often have to really put themselves in a situation and answer, realistically, you can take data that's, it's really not data. You can take just, these comments that are coming back that are misleading, and can then run off and go and build something that you'll discover later on nobody really wants to use. So you really have to learn how to interview people. But, customer interviews are one way to get at this. Other, really simple ways at testing ideas are, doing everything from, putting up a very basic website, like a landing page where you can describe what you're doing, and then just watch what actions people take. So in other words, does anyone try to sign up for this new service that you say that you're building? Does anyone click that, sign up here button or purchase, here button? It's very easy to use a technique like that to test market interest. So in other words, if you put up this very simple website and you're describing what you plan to build, you haven't yet done it, but this is what you plan to do, and you're describing it, and you're going to test, does anyone take an action? So in this case, does anyone try to sign up? And you see, well, you've driven maybe 1,000 people to this website and no one is signing up. No one's actually clicking the button. Well, hey, that's great. You know, at least you learned before you spent significant time building the thing. At least you learned, you know, early on that, you need to go back and, you know, and think this through again. And, you know, there's many other ways of doing this. You know, there's even what I, sometimes encourage people to do where they are working on something that might be a little more, technically complex and there would be a significant amount of time invested in building. I might suggest that they use what's called a concierge MVP. So similar to a concierge in a hotel, you know, the idea of the concierge MVP is that you have someone behind the scenes who is making things happen. And again, so instead of building out a new service completely, you can emulate it and give someone the experience of using it and have, you know, yourself or, you know, someone behind the scenes make it look like, you know, the system is actually doing the work. And, you know, there have been a number of startups that have used this, you know, to learn, you know, quite successfully. It's something that people often don't think about early on, I find. I think because it seems, you know, they want that perfect solution. They actually want to figure out technically how to build what they have in mind. But the real key to the MVP and all these, you know, I guess these, you know, these few examples that I've given is that, you know, I just want people to build what they should be building. I just want people to build, you know, if you are trying to do a startup, so this is a little different from saying that you're going to do, you know, a hobby or you just love writing code, you know, that's all great. But if you want to do a startup, at the end of the day, you've got to make it into a business and you need to have a customer that you're serving. So using MVP techniques are a way to help you figure out early on what you should be spending your time building, if you should be building anything at all. And that's really where, you know, I often have to, you know, force people to, like, you know, okay, let's stop. Let's figure out how we could test this brilliant idea of yours. Because it might just be possible that the first idea that you had is not the best one. Or the first customer group that you think you're focusing on is really not the right one. And using an MVP or a series of MVPs, more likely, is a great way to test and learn.
You know, for those startups that you talk to, and for example, the startups that you mentored and you accelerated with an Accelerator Hong Kong or Accelerator HK, you must have some recommended readings that you give them. Are there some, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 people and their books that you would say, you know, you should read these, you know, these gurus out there because you'll learn a lot from them?
Definitely. There are a few. Ones that I recommend and that impacted me a lot are Steve Blank wrote a book called 4 Steps to the Epiphany. And this has become, you know, I suppose if there's anything like a startup Bible, this is probably it. The interesting thing about this book is he wrote this back in, I believe, 2003. It only really got widespread attention a couple of years ago. But the interesting thing about the book is, you know, this is a hard book to read. This is not a book that you can just sit down and read cover to cover. It's also, I find, you know, a book that I, you know, in the copies that I have dog-eared every page, I've underlined things on every page, made notes probably on every page. I go back to this book again and again. There's always something there. You know, it's hard to read it, and, you know, if anything, it probably could use a little editing, but it's got great value in there. And, you know, everything from, you know, helping people go through this process of moving from what most people grow up thinking about when they think about doing a new, you know, building a new service or a product, is, you know, this product development model that I think has become just an innate, you know, ingrained part of the way we think. And, you know, if you've ever worked in a corporate environment, you're probably pretty familiar with this product development model where you know, if you're going to release a new product that your company is building, you go through this process that's quite linear. You go through a process where you have the idea, you do some market research, you have your R&D team go and figure out, you know, how they're going to build it. You know, your engineering team goes out and, you know, starts writing code. Your marketing team, you know, figures out how to market the service. Sales team goes out to try to sell it. And only at the very end do you encounter the customer for the first time. This is the way most people think about, you know, releasing a new service or a new product. And this book, 4 Steps to the Epiphany, kind of like I've been talking about earlier in that customer development model, it gets you to almost reverse that process and say, okay, let's go out and encounter the customer first and learn, and then only afterwards determine should we be building anything or not. So I always recommend this book, and I, you know, forgive me if I talk a bit, you know, a bit too long about that, but that, you know, it's just a great book to use. Another book and a tool to use is Business Model Generation by Alex Osterwalder. And what I often have startups I work with use, and in fact, what I often force startups I work with to use, is this business model canvas that Alex Osterwalder has developed. So instead of going out and writing a 30 or 40 or 50 page business plan, which no one ever reads and which goes out of date as soon as you've written it, and which probably was not all that accurate, even when you were doing the research, instead of doing that, you can represent your business model in one page in these nine building blocks that Osterwalder describes. So that's another good book to read, because I often find, a lot of these tools that I mention are, on the face, they're quite simple, and they are described quite simply in visual terms. You know, the business model canvas is one page. You know, the customer development model is really just, described with four circles as a way to think through this process. But when it actually comes to applying them, it's quite difficult. So a lot of the background that applies to these methodologies is really helpful. Those are, above all others, those are probably the two resources that I recommend a lot. And then there's also a lot online. But I guess what I tend to see is that, startup people, they act a little different from people in other industries. Because we're doing something that might be a bit new, and because, the startup people, I think, tend to be pretty social. I mean, they tend to like to talk a lot. They tend to like to go and meet other startup people. You're going to discover a lot of other, other blogs, a lot of other online resources. But that's also why I often recommend that people go back and actually, read things in print. In other words, read things that have been around, long enough to have been printed up in book form, which might sound a bit strange, but I often think that's a good way to get people to look at, a body of work with a little bit of slowness, and to take a little time to draw back and to be a little more reflective, because it's very easy as a startup person to just do nothing but go out, talk to other startup people, go to events, go to conferences. A lot of the real learning takes place when you're not with other startup people. It's when you're with your actual customer, which most likely is not someone who's working on a startup. And, this book, Four Steps to the Epiphany and Business Model Generation, they help with that process a lot.
You also mentioned Eric. Do you recommend his book?
I do. Yeah, the Lean Startup is also a great book. I tend to, to me, it's a bit more of an easy introduction to a lot of these techniques. He certainly talks about the MVP, gives a lot of case studies there. I think it's a great book as an introduction, and then when you're ready to go a little deeper, then read the other two books that I discussed. I think Eric Ries has done a great job in making a lot of this knowledge more accessible to people. So, just as I had described, Four Steps of the Epiphany as being quite difficult to read, the Lean Startup is quite easy to read. And for a first time, perhaps for someone who's working on a startup for the first time, or hearing about these ideas for the first time, these methodologies for the first time, it's an easy way to get involved and to learn a bit. I also tend to push people, a bit more, and try to get people to actually apply a lot of that, themselves, internally to their own businesses.
Now, you gave some really great tips. There's this online tool, I guess the Startup Genome, Startup Compass, Black Box Accelerator. Have you looked at any of that stuff? I know that the last trip I took to San Francisco, there was some startup people and some investors talking about some of the tools that are available, or some of the learnings that are available with Startup Genome. Do you have any comments, or have you had a chance to look at their material?
I have, and I did the survey that they had, let's see, probably shortly after it came out, I believe in 2011. So I was one of the, tens of thousands of people that did that survey for my old previous startup. I thought it was pretty interesting, and for a number of reasons. One was that they were one of the first groups to, in a very methodical way, try to gather data and then make some sense of it. Gathering data from a large group of startups that have, that are at different stages in their own development, and then providing that data back to the population as a whole. It was really fascinating how they were able to come up with, I think the four different types of startups, and then what was, recommended for each one, where you might have different team strengths at different times in your development, things to watch out for, things that startups in that particular category tend to have problems with. I thought it was fascinating. I tend to take it with a grain of salt as well, and I think I think that's also understood even by the people that have worked on it, that you can't take this as this is just execute on what they're describing. But I think it's great in that it's gotten people to think a little differently about how you can work on a startup of your own, how you can invest, how you could look more broadly at a spectrum of companies doing different things. I like, where possible, taking this data-driven approach. And it's great that they've been able to take a very broad, broad appeal. I think they need to maybe get a little more activity from people in Asia, because I think it is, at this point, it's more of a U.S.-focused group of participants that have provided data, and I'd like to see maybe more startups from Asia also contribute to that, or at least look at it. I've tried to do something in Hong Kong on a very, very simple level, a little similar to that. So I also have what I call like a Hong Kong startup survey that I've put out there, and I've been gathering data from what the chief difficulties that people have in operating in Hong Kong, what what concerns they have, or on the other side, what's really good here, what advantages they find here. I kind of wanted to look at this small market of Hong Kong for a couple of reasons. First is, at this time I happen to be living here and running the Startups Unplugged, a boot camp here and Accelerator HK here. At this time I'm here. And while this tends to be a small startup community, it's also very well connected. So I've gotten to meet a very broad range of people who are working on things in Hong Kong. And anecdotally, I have a lot of this information because I've had coffees and beers with hundreds of people by this time. I wanted to move a little bit past that and actually see, can I gather something a little more concrete, and then use that as a way to pass data back to the community, either of entrepreneurs or of other investors who are looking at opportunities in Hong Kong. And it's been really really cool just working in this market. Which, I think when Startup Compass, or when their Startup Genome project came out a few months ago, and they were looking at the top 20 or 25 startup hubs around the world, it's often very instructive for how does the world see different cities? Not only internally, what strengths they have and the weaknesses they have, what's good and bad in each startup hub, but also the cities that were not yet on that map. And I really think that we should take all this data that is great data that's being provided now, which we never had access to in the past. We can learn a lot from it, and you can take a lot of this and the best thing is that you can read it, you can decide what is really most useful to you as an individual entrepreneur or you as a collective community. And it's a great way to help you kind of think through, where do you want to be in the next few years? If you're trying to grow a community, where do you want it to go? What are some of the things that you should look out for? Overall, kind of like I said before, I do take this with a grain of salt. I don't think it's gospel, but I'm always happy to look at data that's been collected, and across a spectrum of people. And trying to do the same thing here, and I'm sure no matter where I end up, I'll try to do the same thing there as well, in terms of collecting data from other startups and providing it back to the community.
It's interesting you talked about collecting data. Is that available through Accelerator HK or your Startups Unplugged? Is there a place where some of the experiences that you've been able to obtain through your great career, is that accessible publicly?
The data that's publicly accessible, whether you call it data or not, you can really find it best through, I think, probably two blogs for the Accelerator. So Steve Forte, who I work with on the Accelerator, who's been a great partner in all of this, he has a blog, which I believe is just steveforte.net. There's also a blog that I write, which I call startupsunplugged.com. And you'll see that's a little bit more information on what I've been dealing with, things that I see people working on or having difficulty with. I also, at this point, I've been maintaining a list of startups in Hong Kong. I think I'm up to 173 at this time. And I just call this list wearehktech.com. And that's where I've done this startup survey. And I haven't posted the data there yet. In fact, I was just presenting data on it last night, but I'll probably, in the next couple of months be posting some data there. The thing I always find is, day to day, it's very easy just to get very busy working with other entrepreneurs. And I sometimes have to make sure I spend a little time and pull back and go and actually work on some of these longer term projects. And, data sharing is one of those things. But, otherwise, in terms of the Accelerator, on the Accelerator HK website, you can see the list of the first cohort that just graduated last month in February, 2013. You can at least, see all their names, links to their sites, learn a bit about what they did. And pretty soon we'll be posting some videos that we have with interviews of them. So a combination of sources there, a couple of blogs, a couple of other websites. And I think, down the road, I'm probably filtering through some of the data that's been collected.
Paul, from your incredible past experiences, including founding a New York startup and your focus on early stage startups, again, because of all of this incredible experience you have, what are the stages for successful startups?
Well, the stages for a successful early stage startup, I'm probably not going to say anything all that different from what Steve Blank already describes in customer development model. So in other words, you have your phase where you are searching for your business model and for what you should be building. So that's that customer discovery and validation phase. And then later on, moving into customer creation, marketing your company and then company building. Those are really, I think he really has described that quite well. If I would say I'd add anything to that, as almost a pre-stage to those four pieces is to avoid falling in love with your idea. And this is what I see startups do a lot early stage. They fall in love with an idea and it clouds all the other work that they do. And they might not be willing to think that, they might have to kill that idea. They might have to change it. They might have to go in a completely different direction. And I think as long as you remain open to the probability that you're going to have to change things, then it's very easy for you to go through these different stages. I have all of the startups that I work with now for over a year. I've had them all in the very beginning, before we meet for the first time. I usually have them listen to a recording from someone who told a story at a storytelling event in New York called The Moth. The guy is called Ari Handel, and he tells a story called Don't Fall in Love with Your Monkey. And I won't I won't, spoil the story if your listeners want to go out and listen to it themselves. But he really describes very well how he, as a scientific researcher, was first clouded by falling in love with his test subject, and then some of the things that he had to do to get past that, and what ended up happening in the end. And it's a very powerful story, and I find that that startups really identify with it. And I always have people listen to this in the beginning because it's a great reference point when we start to work together, over the months, at the end, even now, a year later, some of the guys I had worked with in New York, when I started teaching, Lean Startup, year and a half ago in New York, some of those really, those first entrepreneurs that I had worked with back then, they still refer to that recording. And I almost think that, this idea of, falling in love with your idea, it's a really important concept to be aware of. And as long as you go into working on a startup with it's great to be passionate about a problem, it's great to be passionate about a market that you're serving, but if I had to add just one stage to what Steve Blank already describes, it would be this, this pre-stage of, don't fall in love with your idea. In other words, be open to potentially having to kill your idea. And I think a lot of the difficulty that people have in not being willing to change, not being willing to experiment, to try new things, it's because they have fallen in love with their idea rather than, being passionate about a problem or about a market.
Paul, again, we're going to mine your tremendous experiences that you have. So what are your success recommendations that you can provide? And this is from building the 2012 TechCrunch Disrupt Hackathon winner.
Sure. This was a hackathon hack called Poachbase. And I worked with an amazing team of three other people, and you can, if you want, you can see all the names of the team. The site is still up, poachbase.com. The important thing to remember is that a hackathon is an artificial environment. We tend to think that it's all about coding, but when it comes to the judging part of a hackathon, so that's you've stayed up all night long, you've built this thing and now you've got to present it. When it comes to the judging piece, it's actually not about coding at all. It's actually about something else. It's about doing something might be a little unusual, doing something that's maybe timely, presenting well. No one looks at your code afterwards, after a hackathon. You need to have something that does work, but no one's really going to look at the code. Everyone, though, will listen to the presentation. And if you're really good at it, people will remember that presentation. And the teammate that I, had, a guy called Jeff Novich, that I had worked with on this, he presented, he was great. He really understood that. And unlike, I think, a lot of other participants in hackathons, he would practice his presentation, throughout that 24-hour period. He didn't leave it to the last hour, which I find a lot of people doing. And, we kind of all realized that we had to go in, focus on one very simple idea, because we only have 24 hours. And, I've done hackathons before. I've done, I think, three or four of them. In fact, I think they were all at TechCrunch Disrupt in New York. But, this last one that I was part of, we were one of the winners. It was really great to see, not only a team come together, and us stay really focused for 24 hours and come up with something that was, that was really cool, but also understanding that it's a lot about the way that you express this idea. And so I was doing the data piece in this team, and I was there. I remember being there, 2 in the morning, and, looking at this, this mass of columns, rows of data that we had collected. I'm trying to make some sense of this because it goes into what we were building. And through a conversation with the rest of the team, I realized, what? I don't need to make this thing perfect. I just need to make it a little better than what exists already. and I need to be realistic because there's only 24 hours here. And it started, you know, at that point, you know, you start to strip away what's not really that helpful and just look at the things that you can get you, you know, a big win that can make it, you know, immediately useful to someone, that can, help you, put together something that's going to be really cool and that people could, you know, ideally use, right after the hackathon. If you look back on what we built, today, it looks very simple. It's basically a way to predict when startups will go out of business as a way to help you figure out when people will be, when talent will be on the market. So it's a bit tongue in cheek. It's a bit funny in that sense. I hope people don't think it's mean, but it's a bit funny in that sense that, we understand that startups fail all the time and yet all of us have trouble finding talent. And so here's a way that you can use data that exists out there to, because we are scraping data from Crunchbase. Here's a way that you can, use publicly available data to help you make a decision. And we realized that we really just needed to provide something that was a little better than what existed, today and express it very well. And so, those are my tips to anyone who's going to work on a hackathon. The other thing that comes out of a hackathon, which I think most people don't go in realizing, is if you work with a team for 24 hours and you see them tired and stressed out and frustrated and things aren't working, or things are going really well and you're figuring things out, it's a really great way to identify other potential people that you might work with. So other co-founders, people who might join up with or who might join your existing startup. I recommend anyone who's going to be involved in running a startup of their own or who's going to join one or is maybe just exploring this idea, thinks that they might one day want to be involved with a startup, participate in a hackathon. It'll take a day of your time, but it will give you, in a really condensed, time period, it will give you the experience of what it's like to work in a stressful environment when you're sleep deprived, when you've got competition, when you're trying to figure things out, when you've got to be able to present what you have built, express yourself, convince people. It's a great way to find people who you might want to work with because you see them in the tough times and you see how creative they can be and you see, how you like working with them in this, in these situations. Even if you don't have a tech background, I suggest participating on a team. There's something that you can do. I'd even go so far as to say that a good number of the people who participate in hackathons or even in winning teams don't necessarily come in from the tech side. I mean, they might be designers. They might be people who are able to, express ideas well. They might be people who, are able to, creatively brainstorm ways that you can approach a particular problem. Hackathon is not only about hacking. I think it's an important thing to remember. But you get a lot out of it. It's a great experience. And, in best case, you might end up finding people that you like to work with in the future.
Well, those are some great tips. Now, we're going to start focusing on Accelerator Hong Kong and some of your experiences from there. And for the next question, then, what are the operational details behind making your current accelerator Hong Kong such a successful startup accelerator?
Well, a few things are, I think, standard, and a few are a bit more individual to ourselves. So the standard parts of it are that, like many accelerators today, we are a three-month program. We have an application process where we select a well-rounded cohort. We look for people that are coachable. We look for people that are working on interesting projects. We look for people that have also done a bit of work to understand the market that they're in already. They might have already tried to experiment with this idea of theirs. They also have a rounded team in the sense that they at least need to have one tech co-founder and one business founder. And, certainly people have multiples of each, but, you at least need two people to come in and, at least one tech and one business, person. So in that sense, we're pretty typical. Where I think we're a bit different is that we're a little more hands-on than is typical. And by that, I mean we're a little more hands-on in the sense that, you know, myself and Steve, we're a little more aggressive in even at times forcing people to go through this customer discovery process in forcing people to go and iterate on their business model canvas, show us regularly what they're doing, show us the data that they've collected. We really try to use this more hands-on approach as a way to make sure that people are learning quickly. We also tend to take the approach of working with very early stage startups in Accelerator HK. So because we are a hybrid mobile focused accelerator, which is again quite different, that tends to mean that we work with people who are very early stage. So in other words, they have not yet gone out and built their native apps. They haven't built an iPhone app or an Android app yet. You know, they're still at that stage where they're experimenting with an idea, and hybrid development is a way that they're going to be able to iterate a little more quickly. So with that in mind, we are a little more hands-on and actually forcing them to go out and have that experience of going out and doing customer discovery. And I use the word force, I guess, lightheartedly, because I've worked with enough people by this time that I know, our gut reaction is to always just want to go and execute on the idea that we have and just, keep our heads down, write code, or, do research from behind the, screen of our laptops. I think, our role in making sure that people get a lot of value out of this accelerator is making sure that everyone is getting out of the building and you're actually going through this process of learning. The other thing that's really important has been we have a great selection of mentors that we work with. And these are people who are really involved with these startups. So they will come in, they'll work with the teams individually, they'll talk to the group. In a lot of cases, I see startups who get to know these mentors have an ongoing business relationship with them. So in a couple of cases, they've invited some of these mentors in to be advisors more formally. Based on where the background is a match, people will end up working together a little more formally. And the mentors that we have are great. They come from a range of backgrounds, everything from they are serial entrepreneurs, some of them are angel investors, some of them are academics, and typically the academics have also either run their own startup or they are investing in startups. So that's a good balance, and I think that's really important. The other thing that I think is really important for any accelerator is to make sure that the goals of your accelerator are really aligned with the success of startups that participate. And this might seem like a strange thing to say, but I've certainly seen programs out there, or I've talked to entrepreneurs who have been in programs where the goals are not completely aligned. And for example, by this I mean, there are certainly programs where it's all about demo day. It's all about putting on a good show. And that can mean at times that the wrong thing is being done for the startups in the program. So in other words, you might have a company that discovers, wow, in month two or month three even, what we're working on is not working out. We've got to drastically change what we're doing. We've got to go back to the drawing board. We've got to go in a completely different direction. And just realistically, because there's limited time left, we're not going to have that much to show by the end of the program, by demo day. Anyone who comes to us and, and says that should be totally fine. As long as you have gone and you've gone through this process, you've actually gone out and, tried to understand what value you're providing, who your customer is. As long as you've gone through that process of customer discovery, it's got to be okay for you to go back to the drawing board. But sometimes I see that there are other programs that are not so open to that, because after all, if you're looking to your demo day as the way that the world judges you, and now you've got, one or more of the startups that you're working with that have kind of, changed direction, and now they don't have as much to show at the very end. If you're looking at that as being something that's negative to the accelerator, you're looking at this completely the wrong way. You've got to be completely open to a startup, possibly coming to the realization they need to change what they're doing. And it's, 3 months is not very much time. So, it's possible that this happens, late in the program. If that's the case, you've got to be welcoming to it. Because otherwise, I think it really sends the wrong message. It sends a message that, you care more about, the Hollywood version of entrepreneurship than you do actually about people, working and discovering and building something that's real. And I think, it also sends the wrong message in that the next cohort of startups will start to figure this out, and they'll realize, okay, we really just need to execute. We don't need to actually go through this discovery period. We just need to execute and then have a nice glossy demo. So that's my one caveat out there, to anyone. When you're evaluating a program or you're evaluating someone that you're going to work with, think about that. Like, are your goals aligned with the accelerator? And this has been, one of the things that I've tried to make sure that we always do at Accelerator HK, that, we're always very open to people doing what is best for their own company. We'll push people very hard for the 3 months, and I want people to go through this process, but I've also got to be open if there's ever a time when people need to change direction.
Well, Paul, I guess throughout this chat, we've been talking about, the teams and, from maybe a general standpoint, maybe some attributes that they should have, and we talked about some of the mechanisms behind what accelerators are and what makes for successful startups, and some of the best practices to follow. Who are the kind of the gurus out there that everybody should read about? But in this actual operational details of an accelerator, you have to choose a cohort. So how do you go about doing that, or how should you choose a cohort?
Well, it's often very difficult because in our case, and I think certainly in the case of many accelerators, you can very easily get a lot of applications for a limited number of spots. And at times it's very difficult to choose amongst a large group of talented applicants. But I like to look for a few things. So one is that the team is coachable, so that they're going to get a lot out of this process, and then they're not going to just keep their heads down and execute, but they're going to be coachable. They're going to be open to trying new things. They're going to be open to sharing with mentors who come in, to working with myself and Steve. They're going to remain quite open, in that sense. Another is that there's just a good mix of people in the cohort. And by this, I mean everything from, that we don't have overlap in what people are working on. So I would never want to bring in two companies that are working on the same thing. Also in that there's a good mix in the ideas that people have, the things that they are interested in. I love being surprised by ideas and the creativity that, that startups I work with have, and the applicants that I've seen have. And then also of course, look for the ability to do the work. So, and look for that, that technical and business talent and experience, and really look for, for someone, if there's any other criteria that I look for, it's probably that there are some examples of other things that, you've built or that you've worked on in the past. It's always good as a way to, kind of gauge, when you were in a situation that maybe had less support in the past, what were you able to build? And this could be something as simple as, you participated in a hackathon, and here's something that you built in one day, to maybe a side project that you had, or even just, some other kind of hack that you had put together, or something that you had discovered and worked on or tried to flesh out yourself. That's always, that's something I'm interested to work on, to look at. But end of the day, I think a lot of those factors add a lot to the whole experience of the cohort. And people that are coachable, a good mix of technical and business skills, having some past experience, being really open to participating in this process, good mix of ideas, that's worked quite well for us, I found.
Now, you did mention that, you know, let's not make the demo day the end-all and be-all, because you're going to have a company perhaps pivot just before, and they come to a really important realization that they're just going down the wrong track, and they need to rethink this whole process, and so they may not be totally ready for demo day. So I guess that brings to mind then, what does demo day look like? How do you organize it? And you have some startups that probably got a lot of attention at demo day. You know, what made them special? What made them outstanding?
Well, I guess I would say, so in a demo day, really everyone has a different goal. All of the startups that participate probably have a little different goal for what they want to get out of that event. Some might simply want awareness of what they're doing. You know, it might be the first time that they are publicly talking about what they're building. Some might want to get customers. So, you know, especially a couple of the ones that had, working apps and, you know, they were already signing up people. They might want to use Demo Day just as a way to get additional customers. Some that were looking for, investment at that time were using that as a way to, again, for the first time, publicly present themselves, and you know, they were able to then attract, you know, some interest from investors that attended that event. Everyone wants something a little different, I find. But a good demo day to me is one where everyone is able to present themselves very well. So something as simple, well, it's really not simple, but I was going to say, you know, something as simple as confidence, but that often takes a lot of time to, you know, to build up and to get very comfortable with how you express what you're working on. But, being able to do that very well, which we work with the startups on a lot, and knowing, you know, what you want to get out of it. And also really using this, I find, a demo day, depending on where you are in the world, you know, a demo day can be a very common occurrence or it can be a very rare occurrence. And, you know, I think there's some places where there's almost a glut of demo days, right? You could go to a demo day, you know, every week if you wanted. Where we are operating, you know, right now in Hong Kong, you know, a little less so. A bit of a smaller community here. But I always find that in any of these events, you should really look at, you know, it's the people that you're going to meet. It's the idea exchange. It's, you know, potentially finding that other partner, that customer, you know, that investor that comes out of it. So startups that do well, you know, in the Accelerator HK demo day or in any demo day, I think go in with their own goal in mind. And really any accelerator program doesn't end with a demo day. You know, it might seem that way, but really it doesn't, because having worked with someone for 3 months, you do have an enduring responsibility to them, or some, you know, they're always going to be back in touch. They're always going to, be updating you, wherever possible. You know, we'll certainly continue to help them out or connect them to people. I think that's really, the enduring legacy of a demo day, that it's a nice way to end a program, but it's also just the beginning to the next stage of all the work that you're going to do as a startup and figuring things out and, you know, going out and building, signing up new customers, growing. So I really look at demo day as really just the beginning of the next phase of your own development.
Well, we're now going to broaden the questions about the entrepreneurship environment and, so not specifically the acceleration process itself, but sort of the ecosystems that are out there. And this will sort of be the focus of the next two questions. And then the remaining questions, we're sort of going to get off the topic of entrepreneurship. So in terms of the global environment, can you share some tips about what you see in the global entrepreneurship environment? I mean, is there anything that you can recommend about that global environment that's out there?
Well, this is maybe a tough question to answer, but you got me thinking about a couple of things. So in general observation, or even actually in my own direct experience in running this Lean Startup Bootcamp, I found at one time, one of the last programs that I did, I had two applicants come in from two completely different parts of the world. You know, they grew up thousands of miles from each other. One was from an urban environment, the other from a rural environment, speaking different languages, very different backgrounds. And yet they both applied to the that Startups Unplugged bootcamp that I do with almost exactly the same idea. And I kept rereading the two applications thinking this is impossible. How would it, like, they're both applying with almost the exact same thing, and yet they come from, there's no way that these two teams know each other. They're from such different backgrounds. There's not possibly any connection between the two. And one of my observations about, you know, what you talk about, you know, when you say the global entrepreneurship environment, one of my observations has been that there is, funnily enough, there can be a lot of commonality in the way people think through business ideas, think through what they're doing, you know, what they're interested in. You know, some of this is good and some is bad. So some is good in the sense that, you know, there are common problems that people have out there that startups are addressing. You know, there are, you know, just basic human problems, needs that are going to be common no matter where you are in the world. There are also things, however, that are more stylish or faddish at the time. And this, you know, perhaps, is, you know, the one where I think we should, you know, look out a bit more, for, or be a little guarded against. So, when you asked earlier about, you know, are there any things that I recommend people reading, or any blogs, and I mentioned a couple of books instead of blogs. And the reason is, I find if you go out and you read the typical startup, you know, blogs, and you find people in the U.S. reading them, and you find people in Asia reading them, people in Europe reading a lot of the same content, you start to think in the same way. And you also start to think, well, the world is made up of other people who are doing startups. And you almost just start to build things like in this skewed version of reality. So I often get really, you know, much more excited about people who are taking, you know, some of their own, you know, unique, you know, individual backgrounds based on where they're from, their own experience growing up, their own experience working, the country that they live in, you know, where they've moved to, and using that to help, you know, inform what they then go and build. And so, when I sometimes see, you know, something like, you know, two very similar ideas from very different parts of the world, I sometimes have to question, are you doing it because there's actually a need that you see? Or are you more, you know, more interested in what everyone else seems to be talking about? So I guess that's one observation that I have, you know, globally. There can be a bit of, maybe, or there's, you know, perhaps, you know, a little too much commonality in the way people are thinking about, you know, problems to address or the way that they approach them. You know, the world does not look like Silicon Valley. You know, the U.S. does not look like Silicon Valley. New York does not look like Silicon Valley. You know, you can address problems that are, you know, huge problems that are out there. You know, access to simple things like, you know, infrastructure, you know, clean water, education, in very different ways depending on where you are. And there's very different needs depending on where you are in the world. So I often think that, you know, that's really one thing for people to keep in mind. You know, you don't need to build what looks like the movie version of a Silicon Valley startup. You know, there's different ways at going about this, and there are different problems that you can go and tackle, and, you know, different ways that you can, you know, discover the solution. And, you know, there are probably things that are not going to be interesting to someone from Silicon Valley, and are not going to be interesting to an investor who really operates just in the valley. But the world is a very big place, and you can come up with your own, you know, really unique things that work for, you know, your home market that might not make any sense to someone in Silicon Valley, and that is really just fine. And, you know, I welcome a lot of people doing that. And, you know, I think, you know, we work on startups, and it kind of brings us into this global environment because, you know, one of the, you know, the definitions of a startup is that you're doing something that is scalable eventually, and that it is applicable on a very broad, you know, to a broad range of people. You know, even if it's a specific niche, they can be, you know, anywhere. But, I think that, you know, keeping in mind that you don't need to build what is the, you know, the popular, you know, mindset or the, you know, the movie version of Silicon Valley. You can have something that's very different. And I recommend any, you know, any entrepreneur to, you know, to keep that in mind.
I guess it's this whole idea of trying to avoid groupthink, and it applies to even within a company. So now on this next question, you know, we talked a lot about accelerators, in sort of a localized version. How will accelerators change the entrepreneurial ecosystem globally?
I think a couple of things will happen. Now, what's happening already is that accelerators are reducing some of the risk for the startups that participate. So reducing risk by giving a little seed capital in exchange for equity, by having a program where, you know, ideally after, say, a three-month accelerator program, you know, any startup wants to have achieved, you know, much more than they would have in, you know, in a similar amount of time if they only had worked by themselves. And helping wherever possible by connecting them to, you know, the right mentors, the right other partners, you know, getting them access to customers. So there's that part of reducing risk. I also think that the growth in accelerators around the world, while it's sometimes thought of as being, you know, there's a glut of accelerators, again, here as well, like this glut of accelerators is not evenly distributed. So it's neither evenly distributed in terms of geography, because most of these programs are in the U.S. It's also not evenly distributed in terms of industry. So the majority of accelerator programs are very, general. They take startups from an entire range, you know, of different industries, different ideas. So you don't see that many industry-specific accelerators, and that I think you'll see more of in the future. So whether it is mobile-focused, you know, like taking a tech focus to it, you know, a tech niche, or whether you see an industry like, you know, financial services-focused programs, healthcare-focused programs, et cetera, I think you'll see a bit of that. And I also think that you'll see more corporate-focused programs, so ones that enable people to either innovate internally in a program, or where they will, you know, where a company or a group of companies in one particular industry will invite startups in to participate and give them some of the guidance and industry experience that they have. But as a whole, apart from reducing risk, making it easier for early stage entrepreneurs to get something going. I also think that it's helping to change the way people think about building something. And I guess that what I mean is I wouldn't be surprised if what we see happen years down the road is that some of the methods that, you know, we've been discussing, you know, customer development methodology, you know, lean startup, or this whole idea of having a concrete program like an accelerator or a bootcamp that will take you as an entrepreneur, you know, through this process and help guide you along the way. I wouldn't be surprised if that concept even gets introduced into something like a school, and we'll have kids at an early age be able to maybe experiment with new ideas and test different ideas in ways that they never would have thought about in the past. So I can almost imagine that happening as just kind of a follow-on to growth and accelerator programs.
Okay, Paul, we're shifting to our last series of questions, and these next two are not really related to entrepreneurship, but especially this next question specifically, and this is about computing. And in fact, I come from the computing field, and there's, you know, sort of a lot of discussion about, you know, should it be a recognized profession on par with accounting, medicine, and law, you know, where there's demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, recognized credentials. Is that something that you feel should happen in the technology space, and specifically the computing space, and that there should be this movement and involving what we call these elements of professionalism?
So I haven't really been involved in looking at this particular question. And I've also, I think my own experience has been, I've also seen a lot of people who have become technologists, you know, become developers, come to that through a very different background. So either in teaching themselves to code, learning on the job, learning a lot informally, and being able to, to actually build some really cool stuff. Without having gone through any formal training. I'm not seeing, that there's a real, say, need for a recognized credential as a say, a technologist or a computing professional. But it's also because I've seen a lot of people kind of come at this in a very different way. And, you know, whether it's that, you know, they're just, you know, self-taught or, you know, just learning things as they go. So it's not been something that I guess it hasn't really been a question I've looked at seriously, but it's not been something that, you know, at this time I think is needed.
Oh yeah, well, that's a great answer and from your perspective, and I know that there's sort of different points of view. You know, some U.S. government agencies now, for example, are requiring certification in security for, you know, Defense
right.
Department
yeah.
projects, or there's this program now in 10 U.S. states that's reached this critical mass where they're going to start licensing software engineers who are working on critical infrastructure projects and things like that. So you know, it's an interesting question, right? So
and this is also where I'm coming at this from a very different angle. The startups that I work with are typically not working on such critical, like, they're not working on issues of national security, certainly. They're not working on what I call, you know, these issues of life and death, or, you know, very serious projects in that sense. So I think it's a very different question if you do put it in the environment of, you know, here's an individual or a team that's going to work on something for, you know, something for a governmental a client, or something that is, you know, an issue of security, or, you know, it's an issue where you know, the outcome is much more serious. You know, a lot of the things that I deal with are, you know, first of all, they are startups, so they're almost experimental just by nature. And, you know, also by nature, they almost need a way to quickly get access to talent, you know, talent which might not have come through a credentialed, you know, source. You know, might not be someone who's gone through a computer science, you know, program, but they pick things up themselves. So I think there's certainly room for both. And I certainly do see that there are situations in which you would probably want recognized credentials for people that are working on certain projects. It's not what I tend to be involved with, but I could certainly see, you know, and similar to what you were describing, you know, earlier with, you know, an adherence to a code of ethics, you know, personal responsibility and accountability. That's a whole different matter that I think, you know, when you're working on different types of projects, more like the ones that you're describing, there it's applicable. And much of what I do, where, you know, you're working on something very early stage, you might just have a lack of talent, you know, that you can, you know, that you can work with. You might end up completely changing what you do because you're at such an early stage. There, I think it's a really different thing.
Well, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn it around. And that is, I'm sort of putting it in your ballpark and saying, hey, if you were conducting this interview, you know, what one, two, or three questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Sure. Well, I'm kind of going to do a little follow-up from an earlier question about the impact of accelerators, and I would maybe turn it into a slightly different question of, you know, what do you think the long-lasting impact of lean startup and customer development will be? And where I started to talk a little bit, you know, before about how I could see this, you know, accelerator, you know, this kind of program mindset being used in schools, I could actually see this as a way where this, you know, introduction of, you know, experimentation and measuring outcomes and using this as a way to influence what you then build, I could see this being brought into different disciplines. So, for example, there are subjects which we might call, you know, the soft skills, you know, or, you know, the more creative subjects, something like, you know, creative writing, which is taught in schools, taught at the university level, and you have a lot of very talented authors that are producing really creative work. You know, it'd be interesting to me to see if these techniques, you know, lean startup customer development techniques, could actually be applied in some of the more creative industries, where an author, an artist might be able to see, or, you know, test how his or her work is valued or shown or is appreciated by an audience. You know, there's a lot of struggling authors and artists that are out there, and I think this might be a way that they could experiment and see how their work hits people. And I don't even mean this in a, you know, a monetary sense. I almost think that, you know, it could be a way of learning how to express yourself in a different way move from being in a very individualistic, a form of expression into getting a lot of feedback in from an audience. And I think that, that could be something really fascinating to some people. In other words, you can perhaps measure how much readers enjoyed a particular essay in some format. I can imagine people running that experiment. Just like I can imagine, this experiment being applied to, other parts of the humanities. It could also be, used as a way to test what subjects you might be, what subjects you might best enjoy studying, or what jobs you might, be best at doing. I almost think that you could do, an MVP for your life, and that you could use that as a way to test out different ideas of your own, and, in limited fashion, and kind of see, explore what you like doing before you go off and decide you're going to go out and study this university program for several years and then go down this career path. So I could see these methodologies being used in other ways and just in our lives. Otherwise, I think the other question that you might have asked is what are some of the things that I've done in the past that are completely unrelated to technology, but which have an impact on the way I am working today. And, one thing that I found for myself has been when I grew up, I played a lot of music. So I used to play the saxophone, used to play in a lot of bands, had my own band in college, and afterwards, that kind of a thing. Everything from, music that we wrote ourselves, did a lot of improvisational music, to for a while I even played in a rock cover band just for fun. But that experience of having to get a group together, having to organize, you think startup people might be difficult to organize. Musicians are the worst. Getting people to show up for a practice, and show up to the gig early, getting everything, there on time, equipment, in working order, just, making sure that, the whole group, is together and everybody's, playing really well, and enjoying it, as well. That whole experience, plus add on to that, having to then, stand up in front of an audience and play, there's a lot of commonalities there with the startup experience that I've had because, back in the band, it's completely bootstrapped, just like a lot of these startups are. You might make a little money at the door, but you're really doing it because you love doing it. That's what gets you through the day. And, you've got to embrace being in front of an audience, every night that you're out there playing and, understand, well, okay, maybe we're playing, this is the music that we want to play. Maybe we're in the wrong audience, this is a different audience that we should go for that, would appreciate it more. How do we best, present ourselves? How do we become, really comfortable, doing something that most people are not comfortable, which is like standing up in front of a group and performing. So that experience that I had growing up playing a lot of music has been really valuable to me in this startup environment. It's been something that I've kind of drawn on, many times.
Paul, it's interesting. I had a recent discussion with Adrian Cho, who came up with the jazz process, and he actually founded a jazz orchestra of some sort, but he's also a developer, and he's applied that whole jazz process to a new sort of methodology, which is actually considered quite, innovative. And it's being used by major companies. For example, IBM is one of them. And he also does a sort of kind of relationship between his musical background and how it fits into what he's doing now and in the development process of software development. But I would say it also would apply to startups. So it's interesting that you have this common alignment. The one aspect that I'm sort of thinking of, you were talking about customer development. And maybe that process could be used in a creative way for those people in humanities and things like that. But sometimes if an idea is totally disruptive and you try to do some customer validation, they may not be to accept that idea. Or if there's a sort of a bias that's common throughout your particular sort of culture or region and you have an innovative idea or creative idea, it may not be to break through that bias. So then it may, you know, it may stop the process, perhaps, of creativity.
I think it would have to be applied carefully, and I certainly am not advocating that people use this as a way to, you know, simply market a poorly written, you know, piece of work. But I think that, I guess when I look at, say friends of mine or my own experience, even playing music, where I was lucky, I didn't have to depend on music for a living. And it was nice for a little bit of pocket money, but it wasn't really what I needed to depend on. But if you are going into the humanities, and there's such a wealth of culture and creativity and, you know, just such a wealth of, you know, history that is there. But I come from the humanities myself. I studied history undergrad. And I think that we always need to be relooking at these different disciplines and seeing, you know, are there other techniques that we can bring in from other fields that might be applicable? You know, if anything today, the humanities are being abandoned. You know, university students are being discouraged from studying, you know, from going into the humanities or the liberal arts because, you know, they're told, okay, there's no job for you to do afterwards. You know, what are you going to do with this degree? And people, you know, just don't remember that actually, you know, the payoff of humanities, first of all, is, you know, a lot of the payoff is internal in your own personal development and appreciation of, you know, history and culture. But a lot of the other payoff, you know, if you think of it in those terms, comes only years down the road. And I'm just wondering, is there a way to help make the humanities more relevant immediately for people that pursue them, either in an academic setting or in their career? I would hope that one of the things that comes out of, you know, just say customer development, lean startup, you know, the process is that we might be able to apply some things there to completely different subjects, you know, disciplines. And, you know, I really don't know what would happen. I guess I'm hoping that someone will try or get in touch if they're already working on something in this respect. But I certainly don't want to see, you know, even fewer resources go into these, you know, these great disciplines, you know, creative arts, you know, history, you know, English department, because, they're crucial parts of any culture.
Well, Paul, that's just an amazing journey that you've taken us during this discussion here, and I really do thank you for coming in today. I know your schedule is demanding, and you have this incredible success history and entrepreneurship and just leadership worldwide. So again, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with the audience.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me here. Thanks very much, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Paul Orlando, renowned global startup wizard and serial entrepreneur.